Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Director of Global Macro, Jurrien Timmer, joins host Pamela Ritchie for his weekly market commentary. Reflecting on the topic of cash on the sidelines in money market funds, Jurrien shares that as of Friday, March 19th, there is now more money going into equity funds than bond funds for the first time since February 2020. Jurrien and Pamela also look at PE multiples, the U.S. Treasury 10-year yield, and the changing dynamics of globalization, trade, and supply lines, in particular the recent purchase of Kansas City Southern Railroad by CP Rail. Today's podcast was recorded on March 22, 2021, and per usual, Jurrien will be referencing some of his charts, graphs, and research, so head to @TimmerFidelity on Twitter to follow along with those materials. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
We're taking a bit of a breath, a step back. That's what we have in store for you today on the show. Roughly this time last year, the markets crashed, of course, and subsequently much has transpired. The wartime monetary fiscal reaction, the global inoculation campaign, and of course the inflection point we seem to be at today in terms of expected inflation, remaking of value versus growth, and so on. So we're going to zoom out from the day-to-day and try to get a sense of where we are in the broader long-term context. To do that, we're always happy to be joined to frame out the week by Fidelity's head of global macro, Jurrien Timmer. Jurrien, great to see you.
Good morning. Spring is in the air, at least in Boston.
You know, it's been making the moves here in Canada too, maybe a little bit behind you. Okay, my first question is, are we in a period of consolidation?
In a way, yes, right? Because since last fall, there's been a very, very sizable rotation from, you know, the former leadership regime, you know, U.S. large cap growth stocks, to basically everything else, small caps, value, non-US, you know, emerging markets, but as well as developed markets. And I think one of the fears was, or the risks was, that, you know, the FANG stocks, these five big growers alone were about a quarter of the market. And that if you were going to get that rotation out of large cap growth, it would take the market with it just because of the sheer size, right? You have these very expensive, very, very large stocks coming down to earth. And so the risk or the concern was, you're going to get this rotation, you're supposed to get it, you're in a new early cycle, you got all this fiscal, you got a new administration. And so the question always was that rotation going to happen in an up tape or a down tape? Using the word tape as an old dinosaur term from when we actually had a ticker tape.
Well, I didn't
have it. Yes. And so the good news is that the markets, even though they're not making a lot of progress to the upside, this rotation actually is happening in a constructive way, meaning the tape is broadening, and whatever is rising, which is everything other than large cap growth, is kind of lifting the tide, if you will, and allowing the FANG stocks to come down to earth. Because as we know, rising rates have been kind of the big catalyst here for the last few months, as more and more fiscal stimulus was entering the pipeline, at the same time that more and more people would get vaccinated. And in the U.S., we're already at 123 million dosages, I think, and about 3 million per day. So we knew this playbook was going to happen. And when you run an expensive growth stock through the discounted cash flow model, right, it spits out maybe a PE of 35 versus 20 for the market. And then if you move the needle on the interest rate that is used to discount those cash flows for large growth stocks, it, you know, 100 basis points change will move the needle probably three, four times more more violently than for a regular stock. And so that's been the math. But the overall backdrop, the fundamentals are constructive enough, you know, earnings growth, earnings being revised upward, that even with all of those headwinds, the market is actually staying up here.
So bring in, I mean, you're mentioning sort of what we've been seeing in the bond market, but let's go deeper into that. So if we hit this 2%, which the market certainly is challenging the Fed's discussion on that, there's no question. But is that when the period of consolidation kind of hits a wall, or, you know, what kind of catalyst does that provide? And, you know, and do you see that happening?
Yeah, so this is probably the most important thing that is happening in the markets. So the rise in nominal yield. So a year ago, the 10-year Treasury was at 0.5%. Now, for a pandemic crisis, that may have been appropriate, but for a recovering economy, totally not appropriate, right? It should be much higher. I have a very simple fair value model that I'll show you after this next slide, based on nominal GDP and Fed policy, that says, you know, the 10-year should have been at about 1.25%, and the band is 0.5% to 2%. And we are now approaching the upper end of the band. And my sense is that, you know, I'm going to be bullish there. I think buyers will come out of the woodwork. I'm going to be a buyer at 2%. I think the Fed will want to cap rates at that level, either by jawboning or by something more explicit in terms of yield curve control or what have you. But, you know, for the Fed, the message has been bond vigilantes go back home.
The first slide up is the Fed versus the market, tweeted March 24th in the morning. And again, that's at Timmer Fidelity on Twitter.
Right. So this chart here, you see the 10-year yield in the black line. The yellow line is the Fed funds policy rate. And then the dark blue line is the Fed funds curve. So what the market expects the Fed to do. And then the purple dots are the dot plot, right? So the Fed just had its FOMC meeting last week, and some of the dots went up, but still, generally speaking, the dots are saying that the Fed's not going to raise policy rates for several more years until either the unemployment gap closes, which we talked about this last week. That gap is still pretty wide open, at least if you look at the broader measure of unemployment. And or if inflation is not only getting to 2 but exceeding it for a while, and neither of those two things are likely in the near term. So the Fed now needs to convince the bond market to just chill out. And if it's one thing if rates are rising because inflation expectations are rising, which was the case until about a month ago, and that's kind of considered a benign thing. But recently, real rates have been rising as well, and that is a little bit more concerning. Now, a rise in real rates to some degree would be normal, right? Because if the economy is better, it justifies higher real rates. But you don't want that shock like we had in 2013 during the taper tantrum. So I'll show you the bond model.
And this slide is U.S. bond market, tweeted March 17th in the afternoon. And this will be immediately followed by taper tantrums, 2021 versus 2013, tweeted March 23rd.
This is a very, very simple regression model, but one that's been really effective in helping me kind of get a sense of what the fair value is for bonds. So you see that the 10-year went from the bottom of the band and is now almost at the top of the band. And my guess is that 2% buyers will come in. And if we go back one more slide, I'll show you something else, a chart I just created. So 2013 was the taper tantrum, very, very well-known period of time. And what happened back then was Ben Bernanke, who was then at the Fed, was kind of openly pondering whether to reduce QE, whether to reduce its size of asset purchases. And the bond market had a tantrum. You know, the real rate, so the real 10-year yield, rose by almost 200 basis points in 6 weeks. Now that is a shock to the system, to the economic system, to the market. What we're seeing this time around is much milder, but it is being kind of put in the same category. So what I've done here is I've got the nominal yield on the top panel; those are the black bars. And the real yield at the bottom, which is the gray line, and overlaid against the purple line at the top, which was the nominal yield back in 2012, 2013, and then the pink line, which is the real yield back then. And you can see from a timing point of view, the rate reset of 2021, as I like to call it, looks a lot like the taper tantrum of 2013, except of the magnitude with which rates are rising in terms of real rates. The nominal rate is up 125 basis points. It was up 150 last time in 2013. So that's pretty similar. But the key difference here is that the real yield is only up about 60 basis points versus 150 to 200, with the rest, of course, being inflation. And that's an important differentiator and one that should create a more benign outcome this time around, as long as that doesn't change.
You know, tell us what sort of is going on globally that you know, shifts, or, you know, are the outlying risks. Like, I'm wondering sort of an update on the virus, an update on how you're looking at regions around the world. Maybe we'll talk about Turkey in a minute, but just sort of how do you feel about things right now? How do things feel? Is there worry, or is there still much reason to be optimistic?
I think there's reason to be optimistic. I mean, obviously in Europe, the decline in COVID has been far less pronounced than in the U.S., and now we are seeing some new waves. I think in Italy, for instance, we just went into another lockdown. But in the U.S., you know, the news has been pretty good. And even like in the U.K., I think half of all people are now vaccinated there. But they're still pretty strict. You know, my son studies in Dublin, and the cases are way down. But, you know, his favorite pub is still not open, and it won't open for a while. So he's kind of cooped up there. But in the U.S., at least, the story has been good. If you look at the bottom panel.
So this chart here is COVID-19 and the policy response, tweeted March 22nd in the afternoon.
If you look at the bottom panel, that shows the number of percentage of hospital beds occupied by COVID patients. That's gone from 19% to less than 6%. That's a pretty good outcome. And again, it's one thing if that were happening in isolation, but at the same time, we just got another $1.9 trillion. And actually, it's interesting. If you look at the top panel, that shows the accumulated amount of Fed asset purchases in the blue line, the accumulated change in the federal debt in the U.S. in the yellow line, and then the most important one is that gray line, which is the increase in debt minus the cash that the Treasury has at the Fed. And that's important because the Treasury is actually using its cash balance to pay for the $1.9 trillion. And you can see that, right? If you look at the upper right, you can see that little bump in the gray line. That is the stimulus being paid for with cash at the Fed, which is, you can see in the dotted line, that number is going down because it's the mirror image of the other line. So again, you still have that double-barreled, you know, fiscal monetary policy response happening well into what is now a recovery period from COVID and a hopefully soon complete reopening of the economy. And so the natural thing to worry about at that point, I think in the U.S., is not so much COVID. My understanding, not being an expert, is that even with these variants, that whatever is happening that is, you know, with vaccines and mitigation is kind of containing that. But I think for the market, the worry is inflation and the Fed maybe losing the narrative, right? The Fed can't stop the market from raising bond yields unless it wants to be on the other side of all of those sell orders and buy everything. And it's already buying $120 billion a month. And you would think by just from the chart that I just showed that if the Treasury is using only the cash and not issuing new debt, that should be very bond friendly. But even that is not working. And so the markets, you know, are repricing, are pricing for a different regime. And you know, if the inflation pressures are transitory, as everyone believes, the Fed believes, then it's one thing. It'll go away as the base effect wears off. But if inflation expectations were to become entrenched, then people are going to start, you know, dusting off the 1970s playbook. And that's a whole different story for the market.
Yeah. And it's one that you've taken us through. It's fascinating. I wonder when do we know that we've either gotten there to something similar or not? But maybe that's
I'll tease up something for next week, because I'm, you know, I like charts. I like to create different ways of visualizing data. So I'm working on a project right now that I'll show on Monday, just a different way of visualizing the style rotation and how commodities did, how bonds did during important regimes over the past 100 years. And one of them is the 40s, which we've talked about many, many times, going into the 50s, because the early 50s was when the Fed regained or gained its independence. So 42 to 52 is one period I'm going to look at. The other one is kind of from 1960 to 1985, which was a period of from low inflation to rising inflation, then to high inflation, and from a negative correlation between stocks and bonds to ultimately a positive correlation. And it's just fascinating what like small caps and value and what commodities and gold and bonds did or did not do during that time. So that's for next week.
That'll be great. Okay, something to look forward to on that front too. You know, one of the things that you've talked about a lot are it's the changing dynamics of globalization and trade and supply lines. And over the weekend, we heard that Canadian Pacific had bought Kansas Southern to basically make a railroad that goes from Mexico through the U.S. up through Canada and to connect them all by rail, which carries a lot of those commodities that you were just talking about. Just in light of the fact that we have seen supply lines shift, and you know, do you have any comments on just on trade shifting? This might be an example of that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a perfect example, and I think a very promising one, because we know starting in 2018, so 3 years ago already, when the kind of the trade war, if for lack of a better word, started between the U.S. and China, at the same time, you know, the Trump administration kind of redefined NAFTA and created, you know, the USMCA. And, you know, my thinking and many other people as well, and we obviously didn't talk about it back then because we weren't on the air back then, but we've talked about it over the past year, is that if you're going to have a deglobalization regime of, you know, North America or the U.S. doing less business with China or having more trade, you know, barriers to China, it would make sense that you would then magnify the cooperation just in your own backyard, which would be North America, which would be the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And if you think about it, between those three countries, you've got pretty much everything covered, right? You've got cheap labor in Mexico, you got natural resources in Canada, you got lots of consumers. And so it makes perfect sense that there would be more collaboration. And like you said, now you've got a real line from Mexico through the U.S. all the way to Canada. So maybe we'll see more of that. I think it kind of makes sense. And why not, right? If it costs a lot to ship stuff from Asia to North America, whereas you can rail it up from Mexico, whether it's cars or raw materials or what have you, it kind of makes sense. So it's a logical chapter in this story of not necessarily anti-globalization, but re-engineered globalization.
Yeah, it's a very interesting piece. I think I said Kansas Southern. I should have said Kansas City Southern. Anyway, interesting to get your thoughts on that. Let's go. There's a bunch of questions rolling in. I want to ask you a bit about some international geopolitics stuff, but let's get into some of these. So one of them, Urien, are you concerned that PE multiples are too stretched? You talked a little bit about that earlier. Are there concerns? Some people see that.
I'm not that concerned. What's happening right now? So the PE, obviously was very low a year ago, and then it started rising for the simple reason that price tends to bottom before earnings, and we showed those charts last week. And as price finds its bottom, because price is always discounting the future, and earnings follow suit during that period where price is going up but earnings are still going down, the PE is going to go up, right? And then when earnings bottom, then kind of the market, you know, the market can grow into its valuation. So the PE ratio, that's the forward PE, it's at 22. It's actually been stuck there for quite a few months. And really the action is happening underneath the surface in terms of the equity risk premium. So the equity risk premium has really fallen, but it's fallen to kind of compensate for the fact that the 10-year treasury yield, which is the other component of what we call the discount rate or the cost of capital in a DCF model, the risk-free rate has been going up. So the two kind of are always playing off of each other, kind of the mirror image.
This slide coming up next is the market cycle from March 19th in the morning.
I think the best way to explain why valuations, well, A, valuations are above average because we have all this liquidity in the market, right? So that is a very clear relationship. You look at the rate of change in excess liquidity, they match up against the rate of change in the PE ratio. That's not what this chart shows, but I've shown that chart in the past. So the concern would be that if and when liquidity dries up, it should be a negative for valuation, or if inflation goes up a lot, it should be a negative for valuation because there's an inverse correlation there as well. But if you look at this slide, it's a little busy, but the blue lines is the earnings track now versus the average over the past 100 years. The gray lines is the S&P to now versus the average for all cycles. And the yellow line is the PE ratio. Again, the change from the price low. So these are rates of change now versus the historical average. You can see that this cycle actually looks pretty close to the typical cycle. And yeah, the PE is higher than it normally is, but the rate of growth in the PE is actually very much in line with what we've seen in past cycles. So it's higher than it normally is because rates are lower and because there's more liquidity in the system.
Yeah, it's been fascinating having you take us through so many charts that do show to what extent history has been followed. I mean, obviously there are certain areas where it hasn't, but sort of surprising in all the areas that have. Okay, lots of questions here. Follow up to the bond discussion that we were having there. So what would happen if the Fed bond buying program was reduced? What would be, you know, what would you see?
First of all, it's not going to happen, but B, if the Fed were to taper its asset purchases, it would be a problem for the bond market because even now, there are obviously more sellers than buyers out there because otherwise yields would not be rising, right? So, by the way, if anyone ever asks you, not you particularly, but in the audience and they ever want to be clever, it's like, why is the market down? My answer always is, oh, more sellers than buyers. So that's always a very good way to answer that question.
Yeah.
But the Fed's doing $120 billion of asset purchases. Some of that is mortgages, some of that is treasuries. If it were, and it that needs to keep up with the amount of debt that is being issued. Now, like we said earlier, the current fiscal stimulus is not being paid with new debt. It's being paid with the cash balance at the Fed that the Treasury has. But, you know, those two are going to be running neck and neck. The Fed will not going to have any choice because if rates rise for the wrong reasons, so not because of inflation expectations, but because of real rates, the Fed rightfully knows that it could kind of stop the recovery dead in its track.
And this slide is fiscal and monetary policy, tweeted the afternoon of March 23rd.
So we look at unemployment, the U3 unemployment rate, which is the narrow version of unemployment in the U.S. The spread between that and what's considered the natural rate of unemployment is only 1.7%. It was 10% last year. So that gap is coming down. But the U6 gap, which is the broader version of unemployment, including discouraged workers, you know, people who are working part-time that would like to be working full-time, I think both the Treasury and the Fed are running policy aimed at that broader definition. Think of it as an ESG kind of fiscal monetary policy regime. And again, in the bottom panel of this chart, you see the change in the debt versus the change in the Fed's asset purchases. You can see that those two lines are almost identical. So this is debt monetization, basically. And I think it will continue until that 6.6% gap of the U6 rate over the natural rate gets much, much smaller, which it will in the coming months as the economy hopefully reopens. But it could take a few years for that gap to really get a lot lower than it is now. And that's basically what the Fed has been saying, that don't expect us to taper purchases or raise rates for a couple of years until we see the whites of the eyes in inflation. And even if it sees the inflation, it's going to explain it away as being transitory. And again, the risk in that is that it's not transitory and that inflation expectations become entrenched and that by then the genie will be out of the bottle and the Fed can't put it back in. But it's a risk that the Fed is willing to take because it's almost like the Fed has gone from a dual mandate of full employment and 2% inflation to a single mandate of full employment. using the broadest kind of definition, and it'll bring the other mandate back when inflation actually is averaging above 2%, which it hasn't for over 10 years.
So pretty long way to go on that front. Here's a question for an update on cash on the sidelines, sort of levels, and the question is, are you seeing it be deployed in any new way?
Yep, we are. And so money is coming back into the stock market. It has been for a few months, and it's really accelerating now. And, you know, this is the irony, of course, right? A year ago, I mean, not that I had the crystal ball a year ago to say this is absolutely the bottom, but, you know, I got more constructive a year ago for a number of technical reasons. And money was leaving, of course, the markets. And then it started coming back in November once we got past the election uncertainty, although that uncertainty actually carried over into this year. But you see these flows into U.S., all equity funds and ETFs. And you could look at that and say, oh, my God, the contrarian in me wants to run away. Market's overbought. But I don't know. To me, this comes after many, many years of investors shunning equities. And since COVID happened, $1.15 trillion going into money market funds at the expense of bond funds and equity funds. Now, as of last Friday, finally, there's more money going into stock funds than into bond funds. But it's taken a year and a 75% gain in the stock market to finally get to this milestone. And so to me, this tells me that still $733 billion that has come in since COVID happened that has not yet left. It is leaving gradually, but and only slightly more of it is going into equities than in bonds. But to me, this does not show a market that is completely off of its rocker.
Oh, fascinating. Those are amazing lines there. There's a question here from someone. The Buffett indicator is back in the news. Any comments?
Yeah, you know, that's actually on my to-do list of exploring, because I've seen that indicator trotted out. And so the Buffett indicator is the stock market's capitalization relative to GDP, to U.S. GDP. There's a couple of big problems with that indicator. One is that the S&P 500 is not really a U.S. index anymore, right? I mean, Apple is not, it's a U.S. company, it's domiciled there, but it's a global company. So in a way, you need to look at S&P versus some measure that represents, you know, what goes into that index. And that's why we look at price to earnings or price to sales. But the other thing is, you know, the dominance of companies that are capital light and IP rich, right? They have lots of intellectual property. They don't use a lot of factories and brick and mortar. You know, think about Facebook or think about Google. And so GDP is not going to accurately reflect that. So it doesn't mean the market isn't expensive. It is. It's trading at 22 times forward earnings, which is, you know, in the upper decile of historical valuation. But I would rather just look at earnings or enterprise value or something like that rather than GDP. But it is on my to-do list to get into a little bit more, and maybe that'll be a chart for next week.
I can't let you go just quickly about commenting on EM in light of the fact that the Turkish lira obviously is in a bit of a free fall situation. It has a specific reason. Is there anything to sort of extrapolate into EM generally?
I wouldn't extrapolate it into EM generally. But Erdogan fired or got himself a new central bank head, and it's a cautionary tale in this world of where we're talking about MMT all the time, that central bank independence. It may be inconvenient if you're the president of a country, but there's a reason for it, and so it's a cautionary tale against the Fed or the ECB or any other central bank that they need to manage that very carefully. But it hasn't spilled over into EM, and actually it's interesting because the U.S. has been kind of the star of the show here because of all the fiscal policy, and it seems to be leading the world economy kind of out of the slump, whereas historically that would have been China, because China would stimulate, build a lot of factories and airports and railroads. But the U.S. seems to be doing that right now. But still, when you look at the global earnings growth chart, you can see that EM actually is leading the way out. And those lines are going vertical right now because it's the year-over-year change in the expected earnings number. And the base effect, where a year ago those numbers were at rock bottom, are rolling off. So that's why it's gaining ground so rapidly. But EM is in the charge at a plus 14% growth rate. And so I'm still very constructive on EM. The dollar has been a little stronger lately, but I do think still over the long term that the dollar will probably go down and that EM and other non-US stocks will outperform.
Yurian Timmer, great to speak with you. Thank you. What an amazing set of charts, and we look forward to seeing you again next week.
Great. Thanks, Pamela. See you next Monday.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you next time.